Good afternoon. Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Now, today we're broadcasting live from Gigi's Playhouse in Sioux City. Family and experts are discussing how to create inclusive spaces for individuals with all kinds of special needs. They've been talking today about developing awareness about how people with special needs learn and communicate, how to learn strategies to make your work with these folks with special needs more meaningful, and how to make your space accessible and inclusive to all need and ability levels. Now, Gigi's Playhouse has been having this workshop earlier this morning, and they're taking a little break for lunch, and so we're sort of like here trying to get in on the conversation. I have several people sitting here that were just talking about this, and one of them is speech pathologist Kelly Hoke. Kelly, thank you.
You're welcome.
And someone we've had on before, Don Dew, the executive director of the Disabilities Resources Center of Siouxland. Don, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And also we have Brittany. No, we don't. I'm sorry about that. You're Rachel. Rachel White. You're on the board.
Yes, I'm the Gigi's. Board president.
Yep. Board president of Gigi's Playhouse. Brittany couldn't be here. And we also have Amy Eaton, and you're with Northwest AEA, and you do work with people with special needs. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, thank you for being here.
Sure.
You know, I wanted to start out and talk a little bit with Don about sort of, you know, the sense that the ADA came into effect. We all hear about the ADA, and it sets a lot of guidelines, rules of how you're supposed to have schools, a workplace, public places. Could you just talk a little bit about what the role of the ADA has been and how that's changed things?
Yes. It has actually made things easier for people to have more inclusive and accessible spaces. But when we're talking about inclusive spaces, it also has to depend on what you're looking for. So you're not just looking for people with physical disabilities, you're looking for all types of populations. So say people with autism and other types of developmental disabilities, you're trying to find spaces that fit them. So it's also included in that. So making like safe spaces for them, like quiet rooms, things like that. Things that will actually make it easier for them to be able to either learn or go about their day.
Mm-hmm.
So basically anything from a public area, or if it's in a private house, if you're looking at making a house more accessible for somebody, you know, you have to take into account what type of accessibility you're looking at.
I know that the folks here were talking a lot about sort of meeting people where they are in their abilities, and not sort of like, you know, talking down to them and putting
right.
them a certain area or space, either physically or psychologically, and that seems really important.
Absolutely. Otherwise, nobody will feel like they're actually being talked to, and you have to have somebody feeling like they are equal. I mean, that's what it's all about. And how is somebody going to learn and grow if they don't feel like they're being actually taught correctly or talked to correctly? If it's always from a position of a higher power, nobody is going to learn.
Right, right. Rachel White, is this part of the reason you wanted to have this day?
Yes. Gigi's mission is basically, we don't want another generation to happen without our individuals. We focus on Down syndrome, but we're inclusive to all abilities. We don't want it to be another generation before they feel fully immersed in the community and fully accepted. So it's one of our main goals at Gigi's, and we have programs that we center that around in trying to get them out into the community and get the community into Gigi's.
Now, sitting here today, we had parents, we had people that work with all kinds of people with all kinds of needs, and I was really struck by the very specific questions they had about things like, you know, trying to help somebody get ready to have some kind of work, making sure they have training for work, making sure that they're communicating in a way that other people can understand, and have the people that are working with them or teaching them understand where they're coming from, which is hard sometimes.
It's very hard. Everybody, whether you have different abilities or typical, quote-unquote, abilities, we all have our emotions, we all have good days, we all
right.
have bad days. And learning that maybe one of our individuals that's nonverbal, those behaviors are their way of communicating that maybe they didn't get something that they normally rely on in the morning. They have a certain type of cereal that they like to eat before they go to work, and maybe they were out of that cereal. And then they come to work, and, you know, they may be upset about that.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're nonverbal, how do they show you that they're upset? Through their behavior. And just taking that into consideration as a work site or wherever they are functioning in their jobs, and knowing how to kind of troubleshoot that and keep them as an active participant in that job site.
You were all talking about inclusivity, inclusiveness, and when it feels wrong and when it feels right. And I don't know who to start with here. Amy, could you speak a little to that issue? You are with the AEA. You work with special needs students.
Sure. I work with students from kindergarten through 12th grade, and then also the 18 to 21 year olds. So I get a wide variety of seeing how students are included, or the inclusion in the classroom is. In the lower elementaries, I really stress that, like I said earlier in the panel, is that as a former special ed teacher, I could never have those discussions like they can hear from their peers. Their peers are great models, great role models, great with discussions. They can talk about vocabulary that I would never be able to have in a separate classroom with just special needs students. So that's a big piece of it. As you get older, you know, sometimes we don't want them to always mimic some of the behaviors that middle schooler and high schoolers have, but we also want to remember that that's typical. That
right.
is a typical action of all kids. They all go through puberty. They all go, whether, you know, intellectually they're there or not. We want them to be able to be with their same age peers as much as possible. As adulthood, our hope is that we want them to be in a competitive workforce, maybe with a one-on-one, maybe independently, you know. And so we need to, as we transition, we need to think about how are we going to include them into the world that we live in. Is it going to be, are you going to learn the bus system? Are you going to be able to, you know, call a taxi? You know, how is it that they're going to be able to do transportation? Probably not going to be driving a car. So how, you know, how does that inclusion look? And how is it that they're going to, quote unquote, fit into society as adults?
I know a lot of states have had special initiatives to try and make workplaces more inclusive, so people can feel like they can work there and that there are different ways for them to fit in. Don, what do you think? How do you think that is going?
I think it's actually going very well. Now, like, Disabilities Resource Center is a center for independent living, and we have to have 51% of our employees have a disability, a severe disability.
Really?
The same with our board of directors. And, you know, and we do supportive employment for people. The one thing that I would say is, as far as like doing IEPs in some of
the individual education
mm-hmm. plans.
Plan.
In some of the smaller towns, for people who are on the spectrum of autism or have developmental disabilities, the schools don't really understand it that well. Not like, say, Sioux City does. And so they're treating the students the same as other students. The behaviors are treated the same and punished the same. So it's usually me going up there and talking and talking and talking. So I've had to develop curriculums to teach all of the schools because it is different and they have to understand that. So, you know, it's, that part is behind, you know.
Mm. So it's lagging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kelly Hoke, you're a speech pathologist, and you were speaking about trying to understand where kids are coming from and the things that, you know, affect their behavior, this behavioral aspect. It's not just whether or not they have a psychological, mental, or physical disability. There's all this behavioral stuff going on as well, and it's, like Don was saying, it's different.
It is, and coming from a speech pathology background, we see behavior as communication. So a little bit like Don was saying, it's not always that they're acting up, that they're being naughty. They may be trying to get that need met. They may be trying to, like Rachel said, find that box of cereal that they were looking for the morning. And really it relies on the educators around them, sometimes on peers as well, to help us understand some of those wants and needs. And I know at least through Northwest AEA, we have started participating in significant disabilities grant work at the state level to hopefully spread more of that knowledge to all school systems, not just Sioux City, so that we're getting some more education of teachers. But also we have teams through Northwest AEA for autism team, challenging behavior team, that again, hopefully Don isn't the only voice that's going out into those schools. And sharing the knowledge that there's usually more behind behavior than just someone being naughty. And the more that we can start to see behavior, body language, we talked a lot this morning about starting to put visuals in place. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, thanks to a lot of the ADA, there are now visuals from everything from knowing that you're going in a women's restroom to a men's restroom to which handle is the water on a water spigot, which one's hot and cold. We've come a long way with that of visuals, so that hopefully it starts to eliminate some of these behaviors. We're a more predictable environment in order to get our wants and needs met.
Is there a difference when, say, you know, since the school district here is a lot more multicultural, does that kind of throw in another aspect of this where the parents also might have just issues of not everybody knowing English?
Absolutely. Sioux City, again, I believe is being very progressive in that they have a world languages program, so they have access to interpreters and support staff that understand those cultures, can interpret for us. Legally, we are required during an individualized education planning meeting to present that information in a parent's home language. So even if they speak English very, very well, if they speak Vietnamese better, it's our job to make sure that that interpreter is there so that they truly understand the supports and the plan that the school has in place so that they're on the team with us. We're working together with parents and families in order to best provide the supports needed for their children. Now, in the rural communities, that's more difficult to find for sure, and a work in progress, but we're building that future and trying to address the needs and value the wealth of cultural influence that we have around us.
Hmm. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today we're out at Gigi's Playhouse talking about inclusivity, accessibility for people with all kinds of needs. I'm here with Don Du, and Don is the Executive Director of the Disabilities Resources Center of Siouxland. Also, speech pathologist Kelly Hoke. Amy Eaton is with Northwest AEA, and also with us is Rachel White, the head of the board of directors here at Gigi's Playhouse. You know, I wanted to ask Amy a little bit about what I was asking about, sort of the issues with both, you know, the cultural issues, the language issues, when you have people from another country, maybe the parents don't you know, maybe they're trying to learn English and the kids have their own issues. And then there's the whole, you know, speaking English and connecting with the family.
Mm-hmm. I would say that the relationship building is one of the main things that a lot of schools are working on, because we have such different cultures. And different cultures doesn't mean that your child goes to school and preschool at 3 and 4. Many cultures want to keep to themselves, want to keep their kids at home, and so they don't want to have early access in their homes and be able to have that early intervention that is so important. You know, research shows that the earlier we can get in and start working, they're even starting to diagnose autism and so many other things so much earlier now, even as toddlers, instead of waiting till 2, 3, 4 years old, that the more we can get into the houses. But, you know, we can't force ourselves upon them. And I think that's something that we as a community of agencies have to really work with, of how culturally can, you know, with all those different cultures, how can we make them feel like they are part of us and that we're in this together, that team approach. Because without that, you know, we have students showing up in kindergarten that have never been out of the home, that might be still on a bottle, that might be, because that's just what you do in that culture, you know. And so it's the education piece. I think it's getting to families, getting to different, whether community agencies, and getting, you know, Head Start's a humongous agency that helps get early access to children of all different cultures and abilities. And I think just that continuous education of parents is what we need to work on.
You mentioned how, I believe it was you, talking about how Riverside School used to be considered the, you know, I don't know if it was the official or unofficial special ed school.
Sure. It wasn't very many years ago. I mean, seems like it wasn't very many years. It's probably been 10 or 12 now, 15. But it's been, it seems like over the years. But Riverside, we would say, housed all the special ed, the special needs, the higher needs, more significant needs students. And that was in a time where it was more of an exclusion area, you know. And now that kind of swung back the other way. And Sioux City has kind of spread those out, the different rooms into the different elementaries. I do think along with that, it came apart with the ADA is getting those kids into the classroom and physically being able to get them in. Lots of them had steps and they didn't have elevators, or they were unable to get them from floor to floor, and they might not be able to go to music because that was in the basement. And so now we have new buildings, we have new laws, and it's just a progression, that's a process that's taken over time. But, you know, we talked about earlier that the fear of being around kids that would be quote unquote different. And I think nowadays it's just a norm. They're in our schools. They're around us. They're at our ball games or our bigger brother's ball games or whatever. And so I think that more of that fear is gone, but it's, again, it's a process, and it continues with the ADA or in our education world, we call it FAPE, free and appropriate education. That's a law that we live by, that every child, no matter what their disability is, they are entitled to that. So, I mean, I think we've come a long ways, and like one of the other panelists said, you know, it's still a work in progress. Mm-hmm. Work in progress.
You know, if you go into the schools and even, you know, substitute teach, you sometimes I would go down and help with some of the kids that were more profoundly affected. Mm-hmm. And it's very eye-opening if you've never worked with these kids. Mm-hmm. At first, it's very upsetting because you have never worked with kids who've been affected at this level, but you kind of get used to it, and it takes a little while to figure out even how to communicate with them.
Absolutely.
I bet you hear that a lot.
Oh, well, we do.
There's a lot of work being done with that. Even those kids are now being integrated into classrooms. We have the elementary school that I serve has kids that are medically fragile. And some of those, that could mean they're diabetic, and you have to notice within minutes if their blood sugar is dropping. So we have some wonderful teachers and paraprofessionals that have actually done some learning on the medical side of things, of what to watch for. We have some new behavioral programs that are helping with that communication side of things. And then new learning in the communication world with things called core boards, which are words that everyone uses the majority of the time. And then we add in what are called fringe vocabulary, so your favorite kinds of words. But you're right, in working in those classrooms, it's initially kind of shocking to come in and really realize the needs of these students.
Right.
And I would safely say we're seeing more and more complex needs coming into the school district. So it might not just be Down syndrome, it might not just be autism, but there are some mental illness kinds of issues that we're also seeing now. But what I've seen in the 13 years I've been in the school is it's gone from having an expectation of those students to hopefully maybe being able to tie their shoes to now being able to read and write. And so we have raised the expectations for all kids, really. But there was a statistic in one of the conferences I attended with Emily Thatcher, who's the head of the special education part of the Department of Education, that if we can get children reading at a first grade level, they are 90% less likely to be abused in their life. That's incredible.
That is.
So yes, it might take us till they're seniors in high school for them to be reading at that first grade level, but it could make a huge impact in their quality of life.
They can communicate.
Exactly. They could communicate it. They can write it. They can read it. They could read a stop sign. They can keep themselves out of danger. There are just some effects to saying, you know what, it's more than just them being able to feed themselves. It's them being able to advocate for themselves, maybe in a different way and most likely in a different way than what we would expect, but enough that it certainly adds a level of quality for them. And we had some attenders from the juvenile detention center. Our hope is that it keeps some of those kids from making a mistake that would land them there.
Right. Right. Don, do you have an opinion on that, what she was just saying? That was a bad question on my part. She was talking about that and being able to read. I don't know. Do you work with folks who are sort of struggling to read still?
We do. And, you know, it is something where it does help them in life in so many different ways. And so, I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. But yeah, I mean, it's the expectations for somebody should always be as high as they can make them themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And even higher sometimes, because sometimes you have to raise their own expectations.
Right, right. I remember when I was in school, if somebody had any kind of difficulty in learning or anything, it was almost like they would just, after third or fourth grade, they just disappeared. Mm-hmm. And no one ever said anything about them. It was rather frightening to the rest of us, because like, can we disappear? And where did they go? And that just doesn't happen now.
No, it definitely does not.
I think one of the mind shift change that we're working toward, and we're part way there, going into the situation with any individual with different needs as I can instead of I can't. A lot of our parents talk about, you know, they've gone into meetings before where they're like, well, they can't do this, they can't do that. And just because they can't do that in one setting doesn't mean that they aren't doing it in another setting. So, you know, we as professionals see one piece of the puzzle. So the parents hold the big end of the puzzle.
Right.
So talking to them and collaborating on, you know, this is what we'd like to see for our individual. And if the individual is to the age and can function, participating in that meeting and advocating for themselves, like Kelly said. And what do they want to do? It's their life. They need to, if I was told that I had to go, you know, and work in a grocery store the rest of my life, and that's not where my interest lies, are you going to put forth the effort? No, they need to take stock of what they want to do with their lives, and we need to work toward that goal and not tell them what avenue they go into.
Right. I mean, you're not saying, well, this is all you can do, so you have to go and pack groceries or put cans on the shelf.
You
don't say that now.
Yeah. So pulling them into those meetings as young as you can, and so that they know that all of these people are fighting for me, they want me to succeed, and, you know, telling the parents to talk to their kid and see what their interests are and where they want to go and what they want to do. I know 13 and 14 is pretty young. I mean, I didn't know what I wanted to do until my sophomore year in college, but just to start thinking about it.
Ooh,
so, and it
right.
helps that transition as they reach adulthood.
Right. Amy, I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you're the person who was talking about sort of transitioning mm-hmm. kids from childhood to adulthood. I sometimes out at Western Iowa Tech, I see folks in some of these courses sort of learning some basic stuff, how to get around, how mm-hmm. to deal with money, how to work on all these aspects of life. Do you have a lot of people taking these courses?
Yeah. So at Western Iowa Tech, they offer a program called Project Success, and it is students who are currently in high school on IEPs, and they continue their IEPs through college. They're able to get a two-year degree through Western Iowa Tech, and they have kind of like a home, if I understand correctly, I think they have a homeroom teacher that kind of teaches them those mm-hmm. basic money management, you know, how to budget my time, all those different things, but then they actually go out to the different WIT courses. And so it's kind of like a sheltered community college experience. They are able to live on campus in the dorms if they choose to do that, so they can have the college experience. And so we have all different choices of options for our transitioning. Those that aren't able to go to WIT then would go to the Life Academy mm-hmm. that Sioux City offers, Life
right.
Academy. And that is where we work on more of the employability. Those are the students that we really want to get to be, by the time they get to 21 and graduate out of our program, that they would be able to do some sort of competitive or a paid job. It may not be 40 hours a week, it may be 20 hours, it may be 5, but to be able to do some sort of a paid job. Many of those students spend time at Goodwill, OU, Opportunities mm-hmm. Unlimited, and then they also go out and do volunteer hours. It's to get them out in the community. They learn how to ride the bus, how to do the bus schedule. They do lots of cooking on Friday mornings. They make cookies, and they have a little business, and then they bring them around and sell them, and then they invest that money back into their program. So it's all on that employability kinds of vocational skills. Mm-hmm. They also are involved with the agency's voc rehab, and so then they go through a whole process of what are your interests, like Rachel had said earlier, because I don't want to be a waitress if I want to be working at Noah's Hope with the dogs,
right.
or you know I want
yeah.
if I want to be
right.
work with pets. And so they go through a whole interest thing, and then they actually go out and do some like job shadowing into different agencies and or into different businesses, and kind of then get scored on it, and they either like are a high enough score that they can go on and maybe look into something more of employment there, or they think, oh, that was really not, I'm really on my feet too much. I work with a student that, you know, she has some physical disabilities, and so she's not able to be on her feet, so we're trying to find something that she can do that's sitting. She's very personable, so we're thinking maybe she could be a receptionist or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's all about what their strengths are, what their passions are, just like when we're adults. I mean,
right.
it's the same thing. So right. it that transition is very important. I like to see kids that starting at like 6th, 7th grade to start coming to the IEPs, because we really start talking about what are your hopes. I mean, what do you want to go to college? Do you want to work out of? Do you want to do technical kinds of things?
Yeah.
And they really need to be involved in those conversations.
And they didn't used to be involved. They weren't asked,
no,
were they?
No, yeah. no, they were nowhere. Like you said, they were nowhere around. Decisions were being made behind closed doors, and it's like, here you go. Here's your track. You're gonna go, and you're gonna graduate, and you're gonna go to work, and you're gonna go to college. Where now it's just open to anybody.
Mm.
You know, sky's the limit. Really, for anybody.
You know, I like to ask all of you about, you know, technology, the internet, connecting on the internet. How has that affected this? Because I could see so many opportunities, but I can also see some pitfalls.
Well, I know from a speech perspective, we've been thrilled with the iPad.
Yeah.
So everyone nowadays has an iPad, has a smartphone. So those who have difficulty speaking or being understood when they speak, text messaging, voice to text, even Siri starts to learn your voice patterns and can get you places and do things. The iPad has certain apps that you can use that are communication-based apps that you can walk into a McDonald's and order what you want off of a menu without having to have someone with you to do that.
Right.
And by having those devices much more socially acceptable, you have an iPad, I have an iPad.
We all do.
It doesn't look any different when I walk in. It has drastically changed the life, particularly of people with some communication disorders.
Mm. Oh, Don.
And, you know, the iPad, too, is good for people with visual impairments. There's apps actually for almost anything, you know. So, yeah, it has opened up the door for so much. We do have consumers that, you know, can't really afford those. That's the only thing that I do find.
Right.
So, you know, we try to, like, hold a lottery, not a lottery, but,
raffle
every so often, you know, for one.
Right.
But, you know, most of the people that do need one can get one if they, you know, like if they do have a real need.
Yeah, right. You know, I was reading about a woman who was, I don't know if a lawsuit was filed, but a woman who was, her sight was impaired, and they were supposed to have a thing there, like earphones or something that explains who you're voting for, and then you can say who you're voting for if you're blind and you can't do it. And it didn't work.
Mm.
And no one at the polling place could fix it. And so there's possibly a court case pending about they're not offering equal access.
Oh.
Do you think it's just like, I'm sure they wish they could have fixed it, but there's so many, they didn't know how, you know, and they need to know how, right? If they have the stuff.
I would think they should have been they should have been shown
I feel like this happens a lot, this
it
kind
does.
Of thing.
We often say technology is wonderful when it works.
We say that too.
We do that, I suppose, on the radio.
Yeah,
but we also encourage from the school perspective. So we've talked briefly about a lot of high-tech kinds of needs.
Mm-hmm.
We start off very much in the school system also having low-tech. One of the panelists this morning said there's still nothing better than a pad of paper and a pen.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it might not be a photograph of whatever you're trying to talk about, but perhaps with a paper and a pen there that day, draw a check mark or a scribble for the one. I mean, someone verbally could have said to her, I'm going to say the two choices, you mark when you see it. Or, you know, I mean, I mm-hmm. think we need to continue to think about low-tech options to continue those communication patterns rather than just allowing our technology to become a barrier. So, again, I'll use my McDonald's example. If I can't choose on my iPad what I want from McDonald's, they actually have a placemat-looking picture that they can slide across the counter, and you can point to what you want. So as long as we have both options, hopefully it'll starve off some of those potential lawsuits of understanding people are still doing the best they can to provide these services, but it's not a smooth road along the way. And we're going to continue to work on it and hopefully be a little gentler with each other when things don't go well.
Right, right, because everyone wants everything to work right away, and it just isn't like that.
No.
You know, Amy, I was wondering, how do you think the inclusion in the schools and the peer-to-peer sort of, you know, working in communication, how do you think that has affected all the kids, and they see kids in their daily life? I know my daughter said, she's in a wheelchair. It's like no big deal to her. When I was a kid, it was like a wheelchair, you know. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I think we hit on that earlier and during the panel that my kids, my own personal kids, just grew up because I was a special ed teacher and I did Special Olympics and all these things. And then they became Challenger buddies and, you know, Challenger League buddies. And so it just, to me, it was just so out of my realm for a kids to kind of stare and whatever. So it's interesting that the more that we get the kids back in with their peers, the more that they adjust to everybody's equal. Because what they can do, we have a middle schooler that went over to the elementary for field day. A perfect example is that she's in a wheelchair. She's nonverbal. She had a video of her pulling her, she has a motorized wheelchair. She couldn't help with the race, but then when it was all said and done, she took the scooters, or the kids got on the scooters, and she moved her wheelchair and flung them around, you know, in the multipurpose room, and they had the best time. And it was a typical peer and a special needs peer. You know, they were just together, and you would have never known that either one of them were different, because they were laughing and you know, it was just the normal.
Yeah. Right. I have a 15-year-old son, and my favorite story to tell of him, he's the most active kid you could come across. And so he used to get the opportunity to go in with the special education classroom. So he's 15 now. This is even 5-6 years ago, and be a peer model. And I remember him coming home telling me about floor hockey one day, and he had a big like slap mark across his face, and I said, what happened? And he said, no, Mom, it was my fault, my face got in the way. And I thought, boy, if we couldn't all think a little more like that, that it wasn't the child with the disability, they were still learning and they were still trying to figure out how to throw that stick. My son took it as his responsibility to get his face out of the way, you know, even though it got that. So the more our kids learn and think like that, the better our world's going to be in the long run.
You must have been very proud.
Very, very proud. I hope he goes into special education. That natural ability for some people to see past any physical disabilities, any behavioral, and see the person and the soul behind it is a gift. And fortunately, we had a room full of those gifts today, and people who are willing to learn about that.
Right. And I noticed the parents knowing a lot about what the services are and how things work, and asking really specific questions about how to do a certain thing or how to access this or that. Mm-hmm. And I bet that's really helpful.
It is. And it's one of the things that in my job now that I'm out of the classroom and I'm more of in a strategist or consultant position, is I try to work with parents too and build that relationship. So, and I try to lay as much out on the table. I sometimes say I'm brutally honest, but it's like, here's this agency, and they're looking like, oh my goodness, that's so overwhelming.
Right.
But then they have that education of all those different agencies, and they're not scared to call me back and say, okay, now what about, you know, what about Voc Rehab? And so, you know, I go back to, it's that relationship that you build with each and every parent. And I was in a new setting this year, and so I spent the whole year, I felt like, just building relationships with parents and teachers, all, you know, and administration the whole year. So, I mean, it takes some intention. That was mentioned several times. Things need to be intentional. And I think that's what we need to remember, whether it's in school age or out in the community as adulthood. Things need to be intentional. We don't need to just do this because we just think that's the right thing to do. What's your intention? What do you think, you know, what do you think they're going to get out of it, or this community is going to get out of it? So I think, you know, relationships and intentional.
Hmm. What about working with kids that are in the juvenile justice system? They have issues. Sometimes their needs aren't met. Mm-hmm. How do they get their help?
Well, I'm not real sure.
I know that's a little out of our topic.
That's a little out of mine, but I will say that I think, and I think Kelly mentioned it a little bit earlier, is that we are starting to see more mental illness play a role, and I think that is a huge, huge topic that needs to be brought to the forefront, that we need lots more support. If I've said one time a certain doctor, you know, for go to help, I mean, you can't refer to all the kids to this one doctor. You know, we need therapists here in town. We need more support for those kids. You know, that's a good question, because I'm not sure that there is the support and the services for some of those students.
Tough questions and even harder answers. Mm-hmm. And some things that we're finding in the school setting, we're having a tough time addressing.
Right. Right. And also, I think if they have needs that aren't met, I would think that there'd you know, be like that depression issue going on too.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find someone who, in this area, to find a especially a psychiatrist who works with kids. There just aren't that many to go around, especially in the rural areas.
Well, and even to recognize that, I mean, both Amy and I kind of raised our eyebrows at each other because I would assume we both feel the same of we just don't have that level of training.
Right.
And those are some of the complexities that we're starting to see. And our nature when we don't know something sometimes is to go learn about it, but other times it's just to ignore it. And I think we're seeing society in general what's happening when we ignore it. Mm. We see our suicide rates go up. We see incarceration rates go up. And so at some point it's going to be big enough that we need to address it.
Right. And I just, I don't know how that's going to be addressed. Don, you probably see a lot of this too.
Yes. And I don't really know. I mean, I agree
We're struggling for answers.
I figured. We all are. It's really not easy. Another thing I thought about when you were talking is if you have a child, your child doesn't have to be born with these problems. A child can be affected. Mm-hmm. A child can have an accident. Mm-hmm. A grown-up can have an accident in midlife. A friend of mine just had a stroke, and he's in rehab and can't do the things he used to do. So it can happen to anybody. It's really scary.
Mm-hmm. It really is. And I think, you know, we need to remember that it is the brain injuries. It's not something that necessarily is genetic when you are born or a stroke victim. And it spans across. We see kids with brain injuries more than what we've ever had. We've had shaken baby syndrome. Oh. I mean, there's a lot of things out there that we are dealt, and no matter what that situation is, you know, the expectation of the state is you still are going to educate these these students. And so it's a lot of collaboration between a lot of agencies. It's a lot of collaboration between teachers and parents, and to try to get the best plan for success for their student.
Yeah.
Well, and it comes back to the importance of the discussion of inclusion of, yes, you may not be a person with a disability right now, but the more we become progressive as an entire society, should you need those services, should you need the shaved down sidewalk for a wheelchair, should you need the automatic door or the braille on an elevator, you might need one someday. And hopefully maybe we can use that as a incentive for more people to get on board with this of, I understand you, your children, your loved ones may not need this right now. What if you need it someday? What would you want in place for you? How would you want to be included? Do you still want to go to a baseball game? Do you still want to eat chocolate ice cream? You know, what do you still want to be able to do that maybe we can put some things in place now that help people now, but might also help you in the future?
Yeah. Disability does not discriminate.
Not at all.
And, you know, 1 in 5 people have a disability. I mean, if you just look at that, 1 in 5, that's a lot of people.
Yes, it is.
So a disability can include a mental illness. That's a disability, too.
Right.
It could be hearing. It could be vision. It could be physical, intellectual. You know, genetically, you know, we have autism, we have Down syndrome. I mean, it just keeps growing. I mean,
and then your progressive diseases, your Alzheimer's, your Huntington's, your things that affect you later on in your life that come about too. And you don't have any control over that. It comes or it doesn't. And that, I'm sure that's part of where the numbers of the 1 in 5, but you know, you look at the table we're sitting at and certainly affects people sitting at your lunch table right now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it just sort of occurs to me that the world as it was made and built up in society was just made for people who were basically, as you say, typical people to be able to do typical things, to drive a car, to, you know, go up the stairs and do. And it's just really in the last 20, 30 years that this has changed. I mean, it hasn't been very long. You know, and still when I would wheel my dad around and he couldn't, you know, most places don't have a ramp. And you realize that when you're with someone who's in a wheelchair, it's like, well, he can't go in there.
Yeah. My field of speech pathology came about in 1945 out of World War II, the shell shock. There's a the movie out, King's Speech. Of, you know, I mean, it's really a very new field of being able to help and support. Gigi's has been in been around for how long, Rachel?
2003. So.
Yeah, so, I mean, new supports that are coming around every day that hopefully are going to change that world of what we view as typical. We talked about that, too, at the panel this morning. There really is no typical.
No.
No one is typical. No one's normal.
Right.
We all have unique abilities and some disabilities, too, but more abilities than anything else.
Right. Well, now that we're, you know, in summer, what happens in summer when there's no school? Are there other opportunities for folks?
Sure. Schools, so anybody that's on an IEP, they have the opportunity to be looked at and review their data, and they might have the opportunity for extended school year. Many schools use some of their special ed money and do like a summer, shortened summer school. We have some schools that offer going from elementary to middle school, like a transition. So it gets them into that middle school setting, kind of the anxiety can be relieved of, okay, I know where the building is, I know how to get around. As far as community, we have ARC that is held during the summer. And a lot of our parents utilize Opportunities Unlimited or their respite workers during the summer. They might save up their hours and have them used during the summer. So so they have those. Gigi's offers. I'm going to let Rachel tell you what she has.
We have our programs that are, we've got an LMNOP program for our young little kiddos. And one of our board members, Brittany Bush, is the person that spearheads that, and they do all sorts of wonderful activities. It stands for Language, Music, and Our Peeps. Ooh. So they do sign language, they do games, but it's a little more structured so that all of those little, you know, 0 to 3 year olds are kind of learning what's going to happen when they get into that school setting or that early childhood intervention setting. We also have art explosion programs. We had a drama program that was going this past couple months. Our Fantastic Friends program is our 18 plus, and that meets 2 times a month. And we do all sorts of community events, and we also do things here at the Playhouse where I'm one of the people that does that one, and we make dinner as a family, quote unquote. And so they're involved, and I make accommodations for them, so we have a visual recipe that we follow for those that aren't able to do the reading portion, and we take turns doing those things. And then we sit down and have a family dinner around the table right over there. We also have a tutoring program for math and literacy, so our individuals can, every week, we do 10-week sessions, and so every week they come in and they work one-on-one with somebody, and we have a prescribed method out of our national organization that is geared toward individuals with Down syndrome, but like most of the things that we talked about today, pretty much across the board, they would be helpful with any level of disability, and so that meets, and all of our programs are free to families. So we remove that cost barrier.
Right.
And, you know, the more the merrier with with respect to that. We love having big numbers.
Right.
And having to adjust.
Well, you know, this has really flown by, as I kind of thought it would once we started to talk. Thank you, Rachel White, the board president of GD's Playhouse. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for coming.
And also Amy Eaton with Northwest AEA. If people want to know more about services for kids in this area, they just contact the AEA?
Sure. They have a web page. It's nwaea.org. And then, of course, the phone number's there, and you just call and say kind of what your concern or what your question is, and they will guide you to the place, to the department that you need.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. And also, speech pathologist Kelly Hoke, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
It was great. And Don Du, thank you for coming down here. You're the Disabilities Resources Center of Siouxland. Where can people go for more information about what you guys do?
Our website is drcsiouxland.org.
Okay, they can go there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everyone, so much. And we have been here at Gigi's Playhouse talking about inclusiveness and how to meet people with all kinds of needs where they are. I'm Mary Hartnett, and you've been listening to The Exchange. Thanks for listening.